All right. So, doing an interview with Lorenzo Comboa Irvin. You want to just start with talking about your background and your experience, how you came into doing this work?
Well, I was a youth organizer in the South during the 1950s, actually. That's where I first became active in any kind of movement, I guess. I was in the youth NAACP chapter in Chattanooga, Tennessee, in the late 1950s. And then in 1960, the sit-ins came to Chattanooga, and both myself and my cousin, who was older and was one of the student leaders, he actually led, was one of the leaders of the protests from the only black high school in the city into the city center of the city and into the department stores and so forth, and they sat in, occupied the premises. And after they were attacked by the police, however, and racists, and started fighting them inside the department stores, young people from, much younger than the ones that were high school age, my age, which was I was in grade school, and but a whole bunch of us, thousands of us, really, as well as other people from the black community, because at that time, the black community was situated primarily downtown in several large districts, and the black working class people. And so a lot of people left the communities, came downtown to protect the students and so forth. And it was really something stirring to see, where they were shooting high-pressure water hoses. It's interesting that this happened in Chattanooga before it happened in, the more famous case happened in Birmingham. Because they were doing this in Chattanooga and loosing police dogs to attack people and all that stuff. That happened in Chattanooga. But what happened in Chattanooga was that people weren't passive. They resisted. They were actually fighting the cops. They were fighting the stabbing at the police dogs, beating the police dogs back. People were fighting the racist whites that came into the department stores. So it was a whole different kind of thing. And so the federal government called it, when they did their report on it, they called it a riot. Uh-huh. They called it a riot, which it was a rebellion, let's be clear. It was a rebellion against white supremacy. And that radicalized me. It made me an activist. And so it was just one step after another during that period of the 1960s, from just a young kid, then going on to become older and getting into the Black Panther Party, then later going into the Army and so forth. That whole period was about struggle and activism, and it just carried me along. And I was not the only one. It's a whole generation of us just carried along at that time. It's just that for me, the ride has never stopped. Uh-huh. So that's how I got involved in activism originally.
Cool. So what prisoner support movement activities are you currently in contact with and working with?
Well, I'm with a group called the Black Autonomy Federation, and we recently just started, when I say recently, like in the last less than a year, we started a Black Autonomy Prison Federation. And we started it because we felt like the issues of mass imprisonment of blacks and peoples of color was not being addressed by the prison movement. And we still do feel that way. And this is one of the reasons why we started it, to give a voice to all the, to the issue of mass imprisonment of people of color, but also to give a voice to activists who wanted to organize a broad-based movement around it. And so we started it for that reason. We also started around to deal with, in the black community, the conditions that lead young black people to prison anyway, with the gangs and the street violence and all of this. And so we started this Black Autonomy Prison Federation. We reached out to some prisoners on the inside. Still are doing that. We're even reaching out to prisoners that are doing work around prison strikes and so forth now, in Alabama particularly. And these things are coming together because there's a dearth of activism at this period around these issues. There's very little activism on the outside around the prison strikes. There's even less around the whole question of, you know, mass imprisonment. There's less. Mm-hmm. And it's a reflection of the kind of co-optation by nonprofit organizations and by fairly conservative figures in this period, would be fairly conservative, certainly by the estimation by the 1960s, where I come from. Mm-hmm. You know, this lawyer, for instance, was Mrs. Alexander, Michelle Alexander. Well, you know, the thing about her is she herself acknowledges that she didn't even believe what was apparent in terms of mass imprisonment. It had been known for years. She didn't believe it, and only was able to get a voice because she had access to mass media. She had access to mass media, a privileged position, both for herself as an attorney, a corporate a civil rights attorney, as well as for her, the status of her husband, who was a federal prosecutor. So she was able to get publicity, and she appeals to these liberals and so on and so on. I don't care about liberals. I care about people who are being subjected to police terrorism, people who are in the ghetto being starved to death and forced to commit crimes of survival. And, you know, this is the kind of work we're doing right now. We're working with this. And, of course, I try to continue to work with the Anarchist Black Cross because the Anarchist Black Cross was one of the movements that supported me when I was in prison and was very instrumental in me getting out of prison from two life sentences in the 1970s when I was a political prisoner. But also, I've continued on some level to have some ties to the Anarchist Black Cross because it's a worldwide radical activist movement in the anarchist movement. In my estimation, one of the few still around, you know, that, mm-hmm. that has the potential, whether it has reached its full capacity, you know, or not, is another thing altogether. But it certainly has the potential to build a mass-based movement that could deal with a great many issues with imprisonment and the state. Because the state, until I went to prison, I don't really think I understood the whole question of the state terror and the whole issue of what oppressive government is really like, until I went to prison and saw for myself, one, the racialized nature of imprisonment, the class nature of imprisonment, and the terror, the stark terror and murder of imprisonment. I didn't see these things, didn't know these things on the outside. I was like a lot of people. I wasn't naive, but I just didn't know about it. And then having seen it for myself and understood what this meant, you know, understood how a movement in the streets could be built and was built in our behalf in terms of you know, the Attica Rebellion in '71, particularly, a period after that, actually, there was always massive protests. There were 48. There were actually 48 rebellions after Attica, mm-hmm. 1972. There were 48 rebellions, which is still the highest number of prison rebellions anywhere in the country. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so this was a time pivotal to me in terms of my own understanding and my own organizing and activism inside the prisons, and also understanding the power of the movement on the outside, because I'm one of the people that the movement on the outside, you know, got out. I was one of the ones fortunate enough to get out. I was able to get a worldwide campaign in terms of the anarchist movement internationally, as well as, you know, anti-racist organizations that were coming to that exist at the time, and even a wing of the Dutch. I guess it was Amnesty International split because the official Amnesty International had a policy that if you engaged in violence and if you were some sort of radical or anti-authoritarian organization, I'm doing an interview right now.
Okay. That's fine, thank you.
But you know, that in point of fact, the official organization actually split. And it split, and out of it came the Help a Prisoner Oppose Torture Committee, which was based in Amsterdam. And also around that period, the British, the UK Anarchist Black Cross came into existence, and that created the whole new wing of resistance under the name of banner of Anarchist Black Cross.
Okay.
So I was the first American prisoner to be adopted by the Anarchist Black Cross UK. and so it had long ties with them and everything. So I've had a relationship with the Anarchist Black Cross in terms of at least on one level or another. I'm not saying I was always a member in some boring meeting, but certainly I would give them ideas and make criticisms and so forth and so on to kind of push the movement forward and make it more radical and try to even deal with in terms of anti-racism as well.
Cool. So, as you may be aware, there are prisoners who are trying to organize a nationally coordinated hunger strike and potentially work stoppage and other forms of resistance starting on September 9th. What do you think the outcome of that might be, and how can we on the outside support and make it build that mobilization?
Well, it can be extremely powerful. I mean, it can be. I've seen it happen. You know, in the 1970s, we created the prison labor union movement that had between 50,000 and 75,000 prisoners in a brief period of time. And this actually were formally incorporated in a lot of states, 36 states in all, either had fully formed organizations or they were being formed, unions. And it was so powerful, and it was growing so quickly that the prison officials became alarmed. You know, not to mention the strikes and stuff disrupting the prisons. But it was growing so quickly that what they did was to take a case to the United States Supreme Court. They took a case to the United States Supreme Court called Jones versus North Carolina Prison Labor Union, and North Carolina was one of the strongest prison labor unions. In fact, the person who helped me start the federal prison labor union out in Atlanta, Georgia, came from North Carolina. You know, he thinks a political prisoner anyway. He was a civil rights activist framed up in the I can't remember the city now, but they railroaded these three activists. And anyway, he went to prison for that over in North Carolina. They transferred him somehow for whatever reason over to the federal system, and I met him, and we worked together, and we built a group. We were building, in the process of building a group when the decision came down that, you know, they had us all locked up and shipped out and what have you, and broke the movement up.
Uh-huh.
So I think that what I'm trying to say is that is how far it can go. It can go much further than that, you know, in terms of formal organization, in terms of labor unions. I don't know, may even can become the major labor force in this country in this period. I mean, all of this is possible. And as far as the building of the national movement and so forth, of course, the prisoners have to decide in the final analysis what kind of movement they want, you know, and what kind, you know, I'm not going to take that away from them. But at the same time, there are things we can do out here ourselves that we should be thinking about in terms of a national movement. One is to create the framework for a national prison labor union, which is something that didn't happen in the past, but it can happen now, it should happen now. And I think however that's done, it has to be working with prisons, but however that's done, that would be a real step forward. Also, we need to go after every form of corporation or agency or whatever that makes money off of prison labor.
Mm-hmm.
We need a demand. We need to help them formulate their demands. And in my opinion, you know, even though we've got some very intelligent prisoners on the inside who have leadership potential, but we also don't. I said last night we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We need to understand that we can on the outside develop a framework, you know, where we go after these organizations, make them, pressure them to pay the prisoners a decent wage. Many of them on the inside exploiting prisoner labor. And their objective is nothing but, slavery. I mean, they make millions and billions of dollars from prison labor, whether it's run by the state with their own corporation, like the federal government had the Unicorps, as they call it. I don't know what they call it today. It could be something else, but Unicorps, what they called it back then. And most of the states have their own a similar kind of state-based corporation. But then in addition to that, there are literally hundreds of corporations across the United States that have either factories on the inside or have contract workers of the prisoners or whatever, what have you. Mm-hmm. And these are the kind of things we have to address, I think. You know, we have to address this kind of stuff. And so our objective is, we're going to get, you know, we want to get involved with the prison movement. And we want to, you know, express some ideas that people might not have heard. You know, most of the time you have prison activists on the outside that have never been in prison. Now, that isn't always the case. Like last night, myself, Mark Cook, and Ed Mead, and Bo Brown were there. And of course, all of us have been in prison for substantial periods of time. I've been in prison with some of them, personally. But I think that most of the time you'll find that most people who are prison activists have never been in prison. Now, that's not to say that they're not, that they cannot be great activists, you know, not to say that at all. But there's a certain kind of sensitivity that comes from having been an activist in the prison system yourself at that time, and you have an understanding of it that someone on the outside might not have, you know.
Sure.
So that we could build something, you know, that could be very, very powerful in support of the struggle. Because as you look at it right now, we've only had really the three. I mean, there's stuff percolating underneath, true enough, in all the prisons. Mm-hmm. But the reality is we've only had two or three real strikes. You know, now we know they're coming. Mm-hmm. Just like we know that this is going to be a revolution in the streets. But we don't know when and how. And we don't know, and so what we have to do is try to create a framework for it to be successful and to spread. And I think it can spread if we could bring together some kind of national organization, network of activists on the outside, pass in information, pass information to other prisoners and so forth and so on. You know, that's what we need to do. But we need to, as I said, we need to see ourselves as a pressure group on that side.
We're going to go up and see what Paulette's doing, okay?
Okay.
You all right?
I'm fine. Thank you. Take care.
Keep an eye on that guy over there, okay?
Okay. Can you drink it? Can you drink something? Okay. Anyway, so
great.
That's where I'm coming from.
So the next question I had was, how can we include or involve people, prisoners who are in states where there's not a lot of protests going on, where there's not a Free Alabama movement, mm-hmm. or people in women's prisons or immigrant detention centers or other, or even county jails, you know, other forms of incarceration mm-hmm. that aren't part of movements like this.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got to send information to them or get information to them. I mean, we can get information into them better than prisoners in another state, you know.
Right.
So we have to get creative methods of doing it, put it in a newsletter, put it in a letter, whatever, to get the information in to them. But more than anything, we got to create a fervor in the streets for them. See, that's what I keep saying. And if we don't do that, if we don't create a fervor in the streets for them, it won't be as successful, in my opinion. It may even fold.
Uh-huh.
And that's why, you know, you've only had a limited number of them take place at this time. Because there's been no ability to do coordination. You know, and it's to be expected. You're in prison. You know, you're going to try to run it from prison. It'll be difficult. But if you got it in the street, you got some forces in the street in different states that have already got a structure together, it makes it easier. We're not taking anything from the prisons. That's not what I'm saying. We're building something for the prisoners, uh-huh. to be quite honest. And I just think that at this stage, we're not seeing that. I mean, we keep talking about... you know, in individualistic terms about this state, that state, so on. And it's not, you know, I always look at it, people talk about class politics. I always looked at the politics of imprisonment as a class issue. Mm-hmm. I've never had any difference about it. You know, even people I was in prison would disagree with me at the time. When I tried to get the IWW, for instance, to support the prison struggle or the strikes and so forth, and the whole idea of unionizing prisons, wouldn't do it. Wouldn't respond, wouldn't help. When we were being attacked and wiped out, they wouldn't say a word. So those are the kind of errors, too, mm-hmm. that we need to understand. And we made errors in the past, but we also made had victories.
Yeah.
And I think what's wrong with the left and what's wrong with the movement in this period is it doesn't even want to teach its own history, as it is known, or whatever is known. It's not even teaching that to the newer generation of activists.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a real serious mistake. And that's what I've always seen myself as correcting, is that real deep divide in terms of the consciousness of between generations. Okay, what did you do in the 1960s and so forth, and what's happening now? You know, why don't we know about that? Why don't we know about the prison labor union movement, which was so powerful back in the 1970s? You know, these are things that could help right now in terms of building a movement. You know where to go. You don't have to start. Go way back down to the beginning. You can start at a different stage. You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
And so, I don't know. This is what I think. This is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And the group I'm working with, you know, we pretty much agreed that if we're going to come in with it, we're going to try to come in with a program that's broader based and more and non-sectarian. Uh-huh. You know, because you got a lot of sectarianism too. One group wants to show it's doing more than somebody else and so forth and so on. And it didn't have to overall struggle. Uh-huh. You know, it just makes it easier for the officials to come down on us. And the things we're learning in the 70s and 80s, they still apply. 60s and 70s, I should say. They still apply in this period, in many things. You got the same prison official. You might have a different kind of prison system in terms of repression being standardized with the what we call them behavior modification units, but now they're so-called SHU and all that kind of stuff, special handling unit. But all of that happened when I was in prison. We had gone through the stage. We had defeated the man inside the prisons. We had destabilized the prison structure, and we had won some victories, but then we started suffering losses, assassinations, George Jackson, forcible, violent repression of the Attica Rebellion, and then afterwards, mistakes were made in terms of letting liberal lawyers take over important aspects of decision making and organizing of the movement. And then, of course, you know what lawyers do. After a while, even the ones that call themselves radical, they get to where they feel like it's dangerous now. It's dangerous that the poor are going to rise up. It's going beyond the stage of liberal negotiation. Then they start bailing, and that's what happened. You know, a lot of the liberals bailed out, and the rest of us that were left, the rest of the people in the streets that were left behind, were vamped on. A lot of them were prosecuted. Some of them. Prosecuted some of the cases where they came in, they broke up groups. You know, COINTELPRO broke up certain organizations in support of prisoners. But it lasted for a long time, and I learned a lot from that period. Mm-hmm. And I was hopeful that a lot of other people have as well. People my age as well as just others in this period, younger people in this period, including new activists. That's what I'm trying to say. The new activists have. The reason the government continues to hold Black Panthers is not just in terms of punishing them because of their active resistance. I mean, they're doing that. But the reason why they're doing it, the reason they're holding them so long, is because they don't want them to link up with the new generation of organizers in the streets. Where there's some things that even myself, and I don't even get around any much anymore, but there's some things that I can tell people that might be insightful and inciting. that's what it may be insightful on one hand, but insight. You want insight rebellion, insight struggle. Hello.
Hey, I'm always demo with the GB tonight.
The more trouble you make me.
Something like that.
But anyway, so this is what I'm saying. We need to have continuity. We don't have continuity in this. From that period to this, and so there's so many problems because of that. Mm-hmm. Of course, the enemy won out in many respects. The enemy was able to reshape the present circumstances from what had been a victory by the people. They were able to reshape the present social circumstances so that you got mass imprisonment. You got the kind of disparities like I talked about last night with Black infant mortality, with mass unemployment, with so many other things that are really issues that exist in this period that didn't exist in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. You didn't have mass homelessness in the 1960s, even the early 1970s. You didn't have it. And so these are things where the capitalist structure was able to induce more and more misery and poverty onto the masses of people So that now you got mass imprisonment at a scale that has not been seen since the Great Depression, but you don't have fight back. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see it get worse because they're going to go and have more and more austerity measures or calls, put on our heads. And you've already got a mass poor population that has been decimated for years. Mm-hmm. But you have not had a resistance to fight back movement.
Right.
You know, so that's the kind of things we need to recognize. What is being used to stifle protests and what we can do to build.
Cool. Well, I want to get upstairs and see what Paulette is talking about,
okay.
But thank you.
Yeah,
for,
hope you got enough to work with.
Yes, definitely. Thank you. Good.